Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Keith Brown. Today I have the great pleasure of talking to Dr. Moises Naim, who is the author of The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. I hope that you enjoy the interview.
Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Keith Brown, and I have the great pleasure to speak with the author of The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. I have the real pleasure to talk to Dr. Moises Naim. Dr. Naim, how are you?
Fine. Delighted to be talking to you. Thank you very much, Keith.
Now, your resume is well known, but briefly, you've been a Minister of Trade in Venezuela and Executive Director of the World Bank. You've been the editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, and now you're a Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. Is there anything else that we need to know about all of your major accomplishments? Maybe there's something else about your background that informs or led you to write this book.
Well, as you read my background, it's clear that this is the story of a man without a plan. I just moved from one thing to another. Sorry. Perhaps the relevant aspect of my background for the book is that when I was in government, I was supposed and was perceived to be part of a group of economic ministers that had a lot of power. And people would come and ask me to do things or require that the government did or stop doing things. And I knew, I would just look at them, and I knew that they didn't know that it was impossible, that the government did not have the power to do what they were asking, even if very often was very justified. At the time, I just thought, well, this is because in my country, Venezuela, the government and the public sector was always not very efficient. And it was at a time of very complicated politics. We were launching a major program of economic reforms. And so I just thought that was a very unique experience. But then I left the government and I came to Washington at the World Bank, where I had the privilege of talking to a lot of cabinet members and ministers, heads of state from a wide variety of countries from many regions. And it was very common for them to say that they did not have the power to do a lot of things that were expected of them and their government. And so that led me, my aha moment was to start thinking that perhaps this gap between perceived power of the powerful and what the powerful themselves know or feel that they can do, it was a more universal trend.
And I want to talk about that the actual title of your book. I wanted to start here, the title of the book, The End of Power. One of your book reviewers, Francis Fukuyama, had a similar title for his seminal work, The End of History. So why the title, The End of Power, which in many ways sums up very succinctly the thesis of the book. So why this title?
Well, if people take it literally, it is, of course, and then you need to explain, well, you know, Nile Frank, who is a good friend of mine and someone I admire, he didn't say that history was ending. He was just using that metaphor to illustrate what he felt was a very important trend at the time. And in the same way, I am not suggesting that power is disappearing or ending. I am just saying that power as we knew it is no longer there. That power now is much easier to acquire, far more complicated and constrained in terms of the way one can use it, and it's more fleeting. So easier to get, harder to use, and easier to lose. And that is a profound transformation of power.
And speaking of metaphors, you use metaphors in the book, and you know, one of the metaphors that in this area of writing that Tom Friedman used was the idea of the flattening globe. But I was very intrigued by the metaphor that you used, the metaphor of decay. And so you write about power decaying. I wonder what you mean by the decaying of power. Why is that metaphor apt for the description you have of these major, complex global phenomena?
It was my attempt, and perhaps it was not as successful as I wanted it to be, but I do believe it works, to differentiate what I thought and what I think the evidence shows that is happening to power from the notion that power is shifting. The power shift literature is quite well known, and it's there. And we know that power is shifting from Europe and the United States towards Asia. We know that it's moving from north to south, and now you have countries like India and Brazil and China, of course, and that are quite important. And we know that it's shifting from presidential palaces to public squares. And even in some places, increasingly, it's shifting from men to women. Not as much as one would like, but it is happening. And so what I said is I want to document that, but I think it's very important to convey the notion that more than that is happening, that power is not merely shifting, power is mutating. And that means it's decaying. And essentially saying that power doesn't buy as much as it did in the past, and the battles for power continues to be very fierce, but victory yields much less than it did in the past, meaning that those that acquire power immediately know and discover that there are far more constraints in their way they can wield it, and what can they do with it, and how long can they retain it than in the past.
Yeah, and related to this is this idea that you've written about of micropowers. I wonder if you could describe a little bit about what you mean by a micropower and what an example is of a micropower that really defines this era that has made power not go away but become held in different hands and some ways smaller hands.
Let me give you three examples. As you know, the book is not about power only in governments or at the geopolitical level, at the global level, but it also looks at what's happening to power in the business sector or in labor unions, in churches, and in a variety of other arenas and other areas of human activity. So let me just give you two examples. Kodak used to be almost a monopoly, had almost a monopoly on all things photography, film, and all that. Kodak, which was at the time a mega player, a very established, entrenched, difficult to compete against company, was a dominant player in that business for many decades. Kodak went bankrupt. Almost at the same time, a micro player called Instagram, which is essentially an app in your iPhone that deals with photography, essentially helps people manage and distribute and keep and store the pictures. Had 13 employees, had just a few years of existence, and was sold for $1 billion, more or less at the same time that Kodak was going bankrupt. That's one example in the world of business. Another example in the world of war. Pirates in the Gulf of Aden with rickety boats and AK-47s, and very primitive weapons, managed to hijack some of the largest tankers in the world and some of the biggest cargo ships and even passengers and yachts. And you know, they are wreaking havoc in that area. And the world has responded by deploying one of the most sophisticated fleets ever in recent times. And it's a multilateral undertaking with the navies of the Ukraine and China, Japan, Korea, South Korea, the European Union, NATO. Everyone is flying those waters trying to stop these micro players. The mega military powers are trying to stop these micro players, and sometimes they do, but mostly they continue, and they have not been able to stamp them out, these micro players are denying this large fleet victory in that area. A third and final example in the world of religion. In a lot of countries in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, now there are churches that are quite, they are called organic churches, that are versions of evangelical Christianity. Some of them are Pentecostalists that are displacing the Vatican. They are now displacing Catholicism. In Brazil, in 1970, 90% of the country declared Catholicism their religion. In 2010, it's 65%. 500,000 Catholics a year move to another religion. And again, here the mega player is the Vatican, and the micro powers are these independent, very peculiar sometimes, new churches.
And these are revolutionary changes. I mean, these are changing nearly every aspect of the world that we live in, wherever it is that you live. And you've written about these revolutions sort of in three different categories: the more revolution, the mobility revolution, and the mentality revolution. How do these work together? These are sort of analytically separate, but how do these three work together, the more revolution, the mobility revolution, and the mentality revolution?
Yeah, they feed on each other and amplify each other and create all kinds of feedback loops that amplify their impact. The more revolution is simply recognizing the fact that there is we live in a world of abundance. There is more of everything. There's more countries and more political parties. There is more terrorists and more charities and philanthropists. There's more of everything. And starting with more people than ever, with younger than ever, we are now at a stage in which the human population, on average, is younger than it has ever been in history, more urban than ever, more people living in cities than ever before in history, and better off. Global GDP has increased 5 times in the last, since 1950. Per capita GDP 3.5 times more. So there's more people with more material well-being. The World Bank has just lifted 26 countries out of the low-income category to their middle-income category. The global middle class is one of the fastest demographics, the fastest-growing demographics in the world. So there's more of everything, and that is the more revolution. Not only there is more of everything, but that more moves. People and ideas, money, illnesses, pandemics, religions, ideologies, goods, services, everything moves. A financial crisis, everything moves around. And the two together also feed on the mentality revolution, which is a change, a profound change in aspirations, expectations, tolerance for traditional ways of doing things, and so on. And so the first one, the more revolution, overwhelms the barriers that traditionally protected the powerful and helps contenders and rivals and challengers to contest the powers of established players. So the more revolution overwhelms those barriers, the mobility revolution helps challengers circumvent the barriers, and the mentality revolution erodes the barriers. And together, essentially, they end up having the effect of making less protective the shields that behind which the powerful were safe in the past.
So one would ask, from the perspective and the perspective of this podcast, which is based in the field of political science. So what do we do? Can democratic institutions, as they currently are arranged, and the way they currently are arranged, hasn't significantly changed yet. Can these democratic institutions handle these changes? Do they need to become either less democratic or more democratic or morph in some other way that will make them more compatible with these revolutions that you describe?
One of the paradoxes of mature, advanced democracies is that a lot of the checks and balances that are in place to limit the authority, the power of governments, are in fact undermining democracy. and making it less democratic. And many countries are just choking on checks and balances that end up having highly undemocratic consequences. One of the things that one hopes, one of the trends that one hopes will emerge is some changes in the way democracies work. That make sure that governments are not constantly paralyzed, that gridlock does not become the more common word to describe what happens in decision-making at the national and international level, that decisions are not diluted, postponed, or otherwise made in a way that really don't address the problems they're supposed to address. And so we need to move in that direction. And that is only one of the downsides of what I describe in The End of Power, the book. After recognizing and celebrating the many good news that the trends I describe in the book are, you know, we as citizens, as consumers, as voters, as investors, as people, as employees, or employers, we all have more choice, more options, more opportunities. We live in a world of more opportunities created by the fact that monopolists and tyrants and authoritarian governments are less secure in what they in their position and are more constrained in what they can do.
I'm always very interested when a new book comes out like yours, both what the reaction is and whether any of the reaction to the book is surprising to the author. And so you've talked about this book in many places, and you at this point, you know, have probably started to get some feedback on it. Is there any feedback or reaction that has surprised you at all?
Well, the main surprise, I have to confess, is that the book has been well received and is selling well. I was not expecting such a positive, immediate reaction. The book is out only for 2 weeks now, and it's already in the Washington Post bestseller list, number 7. And the book is getting a lot of attention in places that I was not expecting that would pay attention to the book. And so the first reaction is a very positive one. I am pleasantly surprised that the book seems to have touched a nerve and people are interested in its main thesis. Of course, it is some of the points I make are counterintuitive and go against the grain of the common, most widespread narrative that is now present in debates around these issues, which is essentially that income inequality has become more acute, the tolerance for income inequality has evaporated, the notion that a few very wealthy people are concentrating a lot of assets and therefore very often some of them are converting those assets into political power by influencing, you know, political actions committees or influencing buying politicians or playing very important roles in politics like oligarchs in Russia and places like that. So that's the narrative that is very dominant, and, you know, the notion that we are in a world of plutocrats, the 1% that captures a great chunk of the national income and the 99% that doesn't. So I was, when I was writing the book, I knew that that was a national conversation in many countries. And I was very self-conscious that I was I had to address that because some of what I'm saying about the how power is becoming very fleeting and more constrained runs against these notions. And lo and behold, of course, when I give talks or when I'm interviewed, those questions come up almost inevitably. It's not a surprise because, as I said, when I was writing the book, I knew that I was saying something that was going against the grain.
Not every book author that comes on this podcast writes a book that is read by so many people, and for that reason, it's a real pleasure to have had you, Dr. Neem, the author of The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. The book is published just very recently by Basic Books. It's available everywhere. I hope that everyone has a chance to read it. Dr. Neem, thank you very much.
Thank you, Heath, very much, and good luck.